Hey, good evening. Shalom Aleichem, Rabbeisai. We began discussing yesterday the three points of Churban, the division of the Churban into Yerushalayim, Beitar, and Tur Malka. And the Maharal told us that each Churban characterized another aspect of the Churban, meaning a flourishing Eretz Yisrael was composed of three characteristics, one which was really the root of the other two. The presence of the Shekhinah. The presence of the Shekhinah was the source of all the material and spiritual bracha in Eretz Yisrael. And that manifested in two things. First of all, the population. And second of all, the material settlement of the country. I mean, you could have a country that has millions of inhabitants, but it's a backward place, it's not developed. So have Yerushalayim was the seat of the Ashras HaShechina. Tor Malka epitomized the multitude, the great population. And Beitar epitomized the well-structured settlement of Eretz Yisrael in terms of a very great, strong, fortified area. And now he says how the means of the Churban in each of these three places reflected what was being destroyed here. So he began with Yerushalayim. He said Yerushalayim, as the place of Ashras HaShechina, was also the place that brought Klal Yisrael together. As we keep seeing, the primary merit of Ashras HaShechina was the Achdus, the unification. And we began describing yesterday how that Yerushalayim was the unifying factor of Klal Yisrael. The Beit HaMikdash was the unifying factor of Klal Yisrael. As we discussed, this was where everybody had to come to bring their Karbanos. We mentioned the Malbim, who likens it to the heart, where everything revolves around the heart. The blood comes to the heart to get vitalized, to be rejuvenated, and from there it makes its journey to the rest of the body, loses its koyach, then comes back to the heart again. That's how the Aliyah of the Regel works. I want to just spend a little bit more time on our elaboration of the phenomenon of a Beit HaMikdash. We talked yesterday, again, it's such a hard thing to do, to try to move into a dynamic reality, to an experience of life that we've never experienced. It's like, it's kind of like a blind person trying to comprehend color, or trying to describe it to a blind person, or taste to a person who never tasted anything. This is what we're trying to do, and if we can be zoiche to get a little bit of a sense of something, then we've done something. So, first of all, we described the essence of the Beit HaMikdash as, I'm briefly reviewing what we discussed yesterday, I want to take it from there, as what we call the power plant of Ashras HaShechina. The Kuzari talks about this at length, how the Beit HaMikdash was the place where, like, you know, you know, sometimes you pass by these areas, it's like a power station, you see all the satellites, like, you know, a certain fenced-in area with like 100 different satellites of different sizes positioned in different places. I don't know if that's for cell phone, for cellular or what, but whatever it is, what you see there is a whole system, like an electric power plant, that's there to, it has to attract it all, and then from there it's disseminated outward. So it was the avodah, the quality of the avodah in the Beit HaMikdash that attracted, that created the level of Ashras HaShechina that was there and that could then be sent around in Klal Yisrael. So here we talked about the different aspects, the nature of the avodah of the Kohanim. Another thing to say is that when it comes to Karbanis itself, Karbanis for us is an obscure concept. If we get into it already, we try to understand different forms of symbolism. Rabbi, are you going to be doing the Masechta of Midos and Tamid? If you just want to get into it, like, just in a very like real kind of way, get into it, like, to be there. What actually happened there? You'll follow notices about that. But we try to understand the significance of a karban. It remains somewhat obscure. It's a little bit foreign to us. I'm not talking about, not getting into vegetarianism and that stuff. I just mean in terms of why is that something of, like we understand the good tefillah, why that's something of such spiritual value, but why is a karban considered something of such elevated spiritual value? You slaughter an animal and you cut it up and whatever. So the Khuzari says, and here it's again just trying to connect to a dynamic that we never felt. He says that if you tell a Martian about how reproduction works in our world, there it doesn't. I don't know how it works there. It works otherwise. You push a button and you reproduce. Okay? And you try to describe to a Martian how reproduction works. Like, trying to, why should it work that way? Like, why should that cause reproduction? We don't wonder that because we've been living with the reality. I want to note that in a general way. A lot of things that we say we understand, it's not really true. We've gotten used to certain realities. We don't question it, right? A lot of things you ever see a kid, right, dropping something off the high chair. The mother thinks it's trying to be annoying. But the kid is amazed. He's discovering a completely new phenomenon. He wants to see if it works every time. You hold the thing up, you let go, and it goes all the way down. Right? He tries it with one thing. It works with harder objects. Does it work with soft objects? Does it work with liquids? It's an amazing laboratory experiment. He thinks that there's an audio aspect to it also. Later he understands that the mother yelling is not an inherent part of this process. But we now understand it. We understand it any more than he does. We don't understand it. I mean, maybe we can explain it different ways, but that's not really the point. Even a person who can't explain exactly the science of gravity, understand, once he's 10 years old, he understands it. Not that he understands it, he got used to it. Right? Once you get used to a certain reality in a very profound way, we already start calling it that we understand it. Right? So the Khuzari says, bringing a karban, when a person bought a karban, he felt a certain expansion of self. I don't mean a sense of fulfillment, gratification, I did the right thing, I did something great. Not what I mean. I mean something very, very tangible, spiritually scientific, meaning a person underwent a certain expansion of self, a certain clarity, a certain enlightenment of the mind. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but there was something about him that just kind of like puffed up when he bought the karban. A person who experienced this knew that that was the effect of the karban. He wasn't wondering about what is the shot in the karban, what's its significance. That could already become theoretical discussion. But he lived the reality of the effects of a karban. And the Khuzari adds that that went along with the shira of the Levim, the music of the Levim, and the shira of the Levim. The Khuzari goes on at length to talk about how essential music is. Music is a very, very chashuva, how do we say, when you want to facilitate getting something somewhere, a vehicle. But Victor Miller used to greatly irritate people by saying that music has no inherent value. He used to make people very, very upset. He said, its inherent spiritual value, he said, is the same as tickling someone with a feather on the ear. It makes you jump. Music arouses the emotion. That makes you jump. It has the same spiritual value as putting a feather on someone's ear and making him jump. Novo. Is it as simple as that? So, well, it's like anything else. Does a car have value? Car is something very powerful. That's the difference between the feather and the music. The feather has a light effect. The music has a very powerful emotional effect. A car is also something very powerful. Does it have spiritual value? Depends what you do with it. Right? It could be terrible, it could be great, it could be just nothing. Right? So, music is a very powerful kli. But that's what it is, it's a kli. It depends what you are conveying with the music, what you are funneling through with the music. It could be evil, it could be simply nothing, and it could be very great spiritual experience and attainment of a certain level. Now, music is used, right? You see this in the movie industry. It's used to get you into the right mindset for what's going on, right? I actually saw one, so it was very interesting how they were showing how you see an alligator is walking on dry land. Now, you know, an alligator is clumsy on dry land. In water, they're very agile, but on dry land, they're clumsy. You see an alligator is going along, and they play two different types of music as it's going along. First, they played kind of like, it was like, da-da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-da-dum. And like when you're seeing the alligator clumping its way along, it had a very comical look to it. And then afterwards, they did a very dramatic music, which all of a sudden turned that same scene into something scary and suspenseful. Right? This is really the koyach of music. The koyach of music. So the Levim, the Kuzari talks about how the music of the Levim, he says music was a very highly developed art in those days, aimed to hit people in very, very precise ways. And he says today music, it lost a lot of the power that it has because of the, it's not, he says, look at the fact that in Klal Yisrael I had the greatest minds dedicated to music. David HaMelech, right? The greatest. Imagine if we tell you that you have Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to be the composer of Jewish music. But he said, because the Shira of the Levim, when a person was bringing a carbon, a person was supposed to come away in a certain state. And the Shira of the Levim was used to enhance and multiply that state. It was aimed that the person, while he's bringing the carbon, and he's seeing what the Kehanim are doing, and you have the Shira of the Levim in the background, hit him in a way that brought the experience, brought what he came away with to its maximum. So we have to realize this. This was the effect of coming to the Beis HaMikdash. This is what people came for. And that's why Shmuel's father, Elkanah, made a whole program. People had abandoned coming. Then it was the Mishkan, not the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash. He felt like Klal Yisrael was withering. We're not going to get into the historic background of it now, but in the days of Elkanah, Shmuel's father, Beis HaMikdash was kind of like, coming to the Mishkan was something that was in neglect. And he made a whole campaign out of inspiring people to come to the Beis HaMikdash. And it was, Chazal tell us that this was like a major kiruv program for from Jews. Because a from Jew is not coming regularly to the Beis HaMikdash. His life is dry, he's lacking the richness of what Yiddish life is supposed to be. Yes, where are we? Okay, Kuzari says, it's a good question, right? Whatever the case is, therefore Elkanah made it a practice of going every time. He used to go regularly to the Beis HaMikdash. I don't know exactly what regularly means, is not for now. But he would go every time a different way to try to arouse the nostalgia, other people to join him. And therefore he was credited with being the Makar of the Jewish people back to Hashem. And therefore, he was given a son who would do the same thing. This is some of the effects. This was a tangent from the Maral per se, but it's a worthwhile tangent. This is the focus of these days. Okay, we'll end here for tonight.